Hi, this is Aaron. I've got a special bonus episode for you today. In August, I attended the second annual Liberalism for the 21st Century conference in DC, organized by the Institute for the Study of Modern Authoritarianism. That's the group that runs The Unpopulist, a publication I occasionally guest host for on their Zooming In podcast. I led a special live recording of that show at the conference, a conversation with journalist and Reimagining Liberty guest Radley Belko and commentator Charlie Sykes. I framed the conversation around the second Trump administration as a vigorous effort to roll back the civil rights movement, legally, institutionally, and culturally. This led to a deep and spirited discussion. I hope you enjoy this very Reimagining Liberty adjacent conversation. Welcome to a special live recording of the Unpopulist Zooming In podcast here at the Liberalism in the 21st Century Conference in Washington, D.C. I am Aaron Powell, and I'm delighted to be joined by Radley Belko and Charlie Sykes to talk about the situation we find ourselves in. I was thinking going into this, the most striking image to me of Trump's campaign, the months before he was reelected. There's the weird one of him in the construction vest. But the most terrifying one was from the RNC and the signs, the mass deportation now signs, and around those signs, these ugly and sneering and cruel faces celebrating the culture that they were wallowing in. And those faces made me think, as I was looking at them, of the faces you saw in photographs during the civil rights movement, of counter-protesters, of police officers ready to inflict violence, about to inflict violence, to turn fire hoses, to let dogs loose, and so on. And it felt like what we're seeing now, because I think that image, there was a lot of downplaying of that image at the time, but that image really characterizes not just the policies of Trump 2.0, but the attitude that they're trying to inflict upon the country. And it feels like a rolling back of everything that we achieved from those photos in the 1960s and earlier, that movement, everything we achieved from that. It feels like we're in this retreat from that, this conscious attempt to roll that back and reestablish. And so I wanted to talk about that and this moment and that goal. And Radley, I'll start with you. How are we're sitting in D.C. right now as National Guard troops and members of all sorts of agencies are patrolling the streets. How is law enforcement, is this surprising to you, kind of the pace at which these nominally public servants to serve and protect have kind of embraced this role of violence and fear and chaos?
I'm surprised at how quickly it's happened. I've been talking to people about this day, and I think, you know, for the last 20 years, I've been warning about the gradual militarization of our police, which is something that has happened sort of in conjunction with the drug war and then the war on terror over, you know, 40 or 50 years. And that debate was always about how militarized should our police be? You know, how do we balance safety and giving police officers what they need to protect public safety with civil liberties and constitutional rights? And the fear was always that, you know, another September 11th type event would cause what we're seeing now, right? That there would be a threat that everybody acknowledges as a threat, that would cause an administration, states, mayors to crack down on civil liberties. But there would be at least be a like threat that everyone recognizes as a threat, right? We'd be debating about how to react to it. There's no threat. I mean, this is all manufactured. This is all made up. And I was talking to somebody earlier tonight, and I think your juxtaposition of those two images, the kind of clownish image of Trump in the construction vest with this genuinely sort of terrifying anger and the sheer glee that I think a lot of his followers get with watching grandmothers be raided and handcuffed and, you know, dragged out of their homes. And it's like, the two images are so striking, that the clownishness of this administration and the incompetence compared and juxtaposed with the actual threat and the danger and the hate and vitriol we see from his followers. And I always thought, you know, we always hear that story about after the Constitutional Convention and Ben Franklin comes out and the woman comes up to him and says, you know, so what is it, Mr. Franklin? Do we have a republic or a monarchy? And he says, a republic, if you can keep it. You know, that phrase is echoed throughout the ages. And I feel like if Franklin were alive today, he would be sort of like, you know, when I said that, I was worried about like Caracalla or a Sulla or a Caesar. It's like, this guy, you know, like the guy that has to win every handshake, like that's who you're going to roll over for. And there is like just kind of this certain clownishness that like it's easy to sort of, and I saw a lot of sort of libertarian-ish people making this point before the election, like, Trump's not a threat. He's a clown. He's incompetent. You know, he's not dangerous. And you know what? He may be incompetent, but like he's put people around him this time, you know, who do know what they're doing and who are genuinely evil. So that's a very rambling answer to your question. But yeah, I mean, I think on some level, this was kind of the worst case scenario that I never really articulated over the years when I've talked about police militarization, because I didn't want to come off as a crank, right? This is actual military acting as police, not police acting as the military. But here we are, and you know they're threatening to spread it around the country to every, you know, blue city they can find.
Charlie, do you have insights into what happened? Like, why? I mean, this point, like, the guy is a clown. He's rightfully an object of ridicule. He's riddled with pathologies that are obvious to everyone except him. He doesn't know anything. And yet, it's not just that he won, but that it's that he turned not all of the American right, but certainly a large chunk of it into effectively a personality cult. And he seems to be a singularly uninspiring personality.
Well, it's inspiring to his followers. So let me break down the question into two parts. You know, number one, I was in Milwaukee when they were at the convention, when they were holding up the signs mass deportation, which was rather, you know, extraordinary that you would actually put that in writing and begin to cheer all that. This is something that they'd been talking about for 10 years, but you could see that they were ramping it up. But I also think that you put your finger on this culture of performative cruelty and brutality that they have embraced. And Trump has made no secret of that. I think it's one of the aspects of his appeal and his line that he's been talking about this for, you know, many, many years, that his idea of law and order is to have cops who will break heads, cops who will inflict harm. He's talked about, you know, putting razor blades on the top of the wall that Mexico was going to pay for. He's told stories about atrocities. He would, one of his standard stump speeches that I think the media just stopped even quoting him was he would tell the story about, you know, Black Jack Pershing in World War I, you know, taking Muslim terrorists and shooting them with bullets that had been dipped in pig's blood so they wouldn't go to, totally bullshit. I mean, he made the whole thing up. But it was an indication of kind of a bloodlust. He's talked about extrajudicial killings. He has, you know, expressed his admiration for strong men like Duterte in the Philippines who have done this. He's talked about having drug courts that would have trials and executions the same day. So this is not something that he has that should be a secret. What is really remarkable is the extent to which he's communicated that to his base, and that a lot of Americans are not only in favor. I mean, there are Americans who legitimately have concerns about immigration and about the border, But what he's also tapped into is this really visceral hatred of the other and the desire to inflict pain and suffering on them. And I think that that is one of the ugliest aspects of that. And I think you saw that, you know, with the holding up the mass deportation signs. Now, the second part of that is, how is he now going about implementing this with this sort of raw police state masked brute squads sent into the city streets? And again, this is something that he's made no secret of, the fact that he wanted to put active military troops into the streets of American cities. He was blocked from doing that in Trump 1.0, but obviously this is something that he's thought about and wants to do. And one of the most disturbing parts about this is apparently the embrace of these kinds of tactics and this culture by law enforcement itself. And Radley's written a lot about this, but Donald Trump has gone out of his way not only to defend war criminals, but also to defend police officers who've been accused of brutality. So he's basically put up a bat signal to law enforcement that the gloves are off, we're coming in, there's a new sheriff in town, and you know what's happening in Washington, D.C. is just a trial run. He's going to do this. He's going to do this in New York. He's going to do this in Chicago. He's going to do this in one blue city after another. And so the question is, will Americans just accept as normal the idea that you have armed troops in their streets? Now, let me give a cautionary note here, because let's not gaslight Americans that there's not actually a crime problem. I think Democrats are falling into kind of a trap here, because there are legitimate concerns about public safety. So I think that the argument shouldn't be there's no problem here. It's that this is exactly the wrong way to go about dealing with it, because having the mass brute squads on the street is one step toward really running roughshod over a lot of different rights, due process rights, and other constitutional rights that I think most Americans are going to be reluctant to give up, but we're going to see, because all of this is being tested right now.
Yeah, I would just like to jump in on the crime thing. I mean, crime is down in D.C. It's still, D.C. does still have a comparatively high crime rate for a city of its size. There's no question. It's always been that way here. But the idea that there's something happening right now that merits this response, I think is what I meant when it's a manufactured crisis. I would also say, you know, I think it's important to point out that like you said, he's always wanted to do this. I mean, This is just the reason that he's managed to put his finger on and you know, thinks it's going to resonate. I think, you know, we need to talk about crime. We need to talk about what works and what doesn't. I think it's important to acknowledge that this is the crime is just the reason that he's found right now. Like this is something that he's been planning to do forever. And it's about, like Christy Noem said, it is about, basically deposing the leadership in these cities, like she said in Los Angeles. You know, their goal was to liberate Los Angeles from the socialist elected leaders.
No, I agree with you completely about that. I'm just talking about that there is a danger of putting too much emphasis on them, that there is not a crime problem, because in Chicago there's a crime problem, in New York there's a crime problem. People feel it, and this kind of reminds me of, I mean, didn't Democrats learn a lesson in 2024 when there was inflation and they said, oh, no, there's not really inflation here. Let me show you a chart. You know, you can't think that cost of living is a problem, because here's some statistics that I have for you. There's not really a problem you think there's a problem of immigration, that there's a problem at the border. Here, I have a chart showing you that there's not a problem. Well, you can't, if the public honestly thinks that there is a problem at the border, that there's a problem with inflation, and there's a problem with crime, it's politically problematic to deny it. Because as David Frum, I think, wrote, you know, presciently in The Atlantic several years ago, you know what? If liberals will not enforce the border, you could add in, or, you know, keep the city streets safe, the public will turn to the fascists. They will turn to the fascists if they think you will solve this problem and you're pretending it does not exist, or you're trying to minimize it.
Don't want to belabor this, but, you know, I just think it's dangerous to sort of concede the point when the premise itself is wrong. So Trump made crime an issue in 2016, right? The American Carnage inauguration speech. So I would just point out in 2016, when Trump took office in January 2017, he inherited the lowest murder rate in, of any president in the last 50 years. And yet he ran on crime. And I think that is important to push back and say, wait a minute, no, you know, Obama did not cause a massive spike in crime. There was a tiny tick up in 2015, but that was only because 2014 was the safest year basically in recent memory. Trump is also the first president in 30 years to leave office with a higher murder rate than when he entered it. And, you know, I don't think that presidents have a whole lot of effect on crime, but Trump certainly does, right? So I think I agree with you. You know, we can't say that crime isn't a problem, but we can also point out that crime went up under Trump and that, you know, the things that he's doing are going to make things worse.
I think these are all legitimate points to make. It's just that at some point, this is a problem. And Trump has this reptilian instinct to go for vulnerabilities. And one of the vulnerabilities of the progressive left is the problem of governance. And if there is a perception that these urban centers are badly governed, that they are overrun with homeless encampments and crime and carjacking, then the public will see what he's doing as a solution. Now, by the way, I'm making this argument because I think that you can't overstate how dangerous what he's doing is, right, or how demagogic what he is doing. So what I'm saying is that this is going to be a huge fight. He's going to go into Chicago, where I think the mayor has an approval rating of what, about 12% to 16%, and where crime is, you know, just demonstrably a problem. And he's going to say, no, I am here with the cavalry. And so there's got to be a better answer for this, to focus on the real threat to the constitutional order that he is posing here, as opposed to going off in the cul-de-sac of arguing on his ground, which is to say, no, really don't pay attention to all this. And again, I'm making this argument because this is one that I think the country really has to win. Otherwise, we are going to see the militarization of this, and we're going to see an actual police state.
Let me see if I can pull together some of the threads from the conversation so far, because I think there's kind of a nexus or something that needs to be diagnosed to see the way through. When you were mentioning the bullets covered in pig's blood, what occurred to me was I was a kid at the height of like 80s action movies. And that's the kind of thing that the bad guys did in 80s action movies. And that's the kind of thing that justified the muscular American blowing them up or otherwise dispatching them, was that they were the kinds of people who did that sort of stuff. And there's been now a turn that we're seeing behavior that Americans would have said, this isn't who we are. It might have been some of us, but a lot of us would say, this is not who we are. The Christianity that many Americans hold to, this is not the way that Jesus tells them to act. And so there's been kind of a shift in like a willingness to embrace this sort of stuff. And it's behavior that I would have expected to horrify basically everyone to watch it happening. And it is, his approval ratings are declining rapidly. It is horrifying a lot of people, but fewer than I would have hoped. And I can't remember which one of you mentioned it, but someone this mentioned the kind of, on the one hand, there's the cruelty, but there's also the fear, and that those are feeding into each other. And what I wonder is, yes, there's crime, but at the same time, if your media consumption habits are those of a Trump supporter, a committed Trump supporter, you are being told constantly to be afraid, that everybody outside your door, except for the people who you recognize, or maybe the people who share your skin color or speak with the same accent you do, everyone else is a threat to you and your family. And you sit in, I see this with members of my own family who are Trump supporters, like they are just literally terrified. Or I can't ride the subway. It's too scary to ride the subway. Or I go out in DC and I see youths doing the kinds of things youths do, and now I don't feel safe having my family there. And it seems, what I'm wondering is, to what extent did we kind of shift to this, to like a manufacturing of this? We don't have a war, right? We don't have a crisis, but we've told a huge portion of the country, you should be afraid of every last thing, except your immediate family and that guy who now rules the country. And the crime rates are part of it. It's like, you should be scared of every single one of these cities.
And then, you know, one of our speakers today was talking about the power of stories. The demagogues will tell that story, and a story of fear and anger is a very, very powerful story that you can't counteract with statistics. You need to counteract it with other stories. And I think that's part of the problem. And he has made that narrative. So, for example, you have members of your family who are Trump supporters. My guess is that they could name name young women who had been raped and murdered by illegal immigrants. Because, I mean, on Fox News, this is happening all the time, right? You think illegal immigrants, what do? They are criminals. And look at the crimes they are committing. They told that story in the most graphic possible way and then would turn around and say, and you folks, if you oppose what Donald Trump is doing, you are defending these terrible, you know, he described them as animals. You are defending this. So you become the pro-crime family. It is deeply dishonest. It is deeply dangerous. But again, this is it is potent, and we ought to look at it in the face and recognize what he is, how he's going to weaponize those stories and that fear, which is really kind of the story of our era now, isn't it? Because we're living in this era of peace, prosperity, general safety, and yet he's created this sort of American carnage hellscape image story.
Yeah, I mean, I also think there's, you know, there's this weird sort of paradox of masculinity in the MAGA movement where it's all, you know, it's all about, it's not about masculinity, it's about projecting masculinity, right? It's about the co-opting sort of aspects of masculinity. And so it's like, we're the manly men, you know, we need men, need to be men again. And, you know, that's why we support, you know, men who sexually assault women and sexually harass women. And at the same time, you know, we're all going to, genuflect and debase ourselves in front of this 79-year-old man, you know, because he's our leader and we need to like let him insult our wives. And we're also scared to take the subway because, you know, 10 out of 2 billion, I think it 2 billion annual rides on the New York City subway, I think, you know, there were 10 murders last year. You know, the subway is one of the safest public spaces you'll find anywhere, but you'll regularly see MAGA people go on Fox News and talk about how scared they are of it. And I do think there's, you know, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how persuadable any of MAGA is, but I do sort of think pointing out the sheer sort of cowardliness might resonate. I don't know. You know, when Mark Wayne Mullen goes on the Sunday shows and says he doesn't wear his seatbelt anymore because he's afraid he'll get carjacked and he needs to be able to jump out of his car quickly. You know,
he actually did say that.
He did say it. Yeah. And you know, I don't know what the stats are. It's something like 40, somebody pointed out on social media, 40 or 50 more times more likely to die in a car accident than you are in a carjacking. So, you know, he's sealing his own fate, I guess. But I do think, you know, that there's something there and sort of appealing to their lack of masculinity in some of these, when they try to push some of these narratives.
Yeah. I mean, that is absurd, but I do think there are narratives out there. We have the National Guard troops here in Washington, D.C. Where were they on January 6th? Why did the president not bring it when, in fact, we had one of the greatest assaults on law enforcement? And I think you should call bullshit on Donald Trump being the law and order back the blue president when the first thing he did when he took office on his first day or second day was to issue the blanket pardons to all of the rioters and seditionists who not only assaulted the Capitol, but specifically the ones who attacked police officers. You know, you could have every, you know, stand up and say, look, I don't want to be lectured by the man that gave the get out of jail free card to the people who tased and bear sprayed, you know, police officers in this city. Not to mention, before he brings up the whole defund the police thing, who right now is dismantling the nation's premier law enforcement agency, the FBI, because all of these FBI agents who are being gutted or who are being tasked to do what? You know, hassle homeless people in Washington, D.C. You know what they're not doing? They are not investigating child sex trafficking. They are not engaging in any terrorism activities. So I think what you do is you call them out and say, you are not making this country safer. You are not the law and order president. You are a convicted felon. You, in fact, have freed and celebrated people who actually beat cops. If Barack Obama would have pardoned someone who attacked police officers, the right would have been utterly incandescent And yet Donald Trump does it, and he's not called out on it. So I understand that there are some people who are reluctant to be like, well, no, we're actually the party of law and order. We're actually the party of public safety. But I think you hit him right in his, what I think is a real vulnerability there.
And so somebody pointed out yesterday, maybe it was this morning, that one of the guys who literally told January 6 rioters to kill the police is now a respected senior member of the Justice Department, whereas the guy who threw a sandwich at a cop is facing a felony charge. I mean, that is Trump's approach to law enforcement in a nutshell.
I mean, I always hate it when people, you know, go on TV and talk about this should be a talking point, but that ought to be a talking point. Don't you think? The guy who is here, this guy, we had a, you know, everybody ought to know his name, which I should know. His name is Wise, right? So here we have the video of him, you know, saying, kill them all, calling the police Nazis. And he is now a top official in Donald Trump's Justice Department.
I think to complicate that messaging, though, and this is my concern, and this allows me to belabor my civil rights movement point some more as well, is one of the reasons that the anti-civil rights movement, the counter movement, was as vicious and as ugly as it is because it was a group of people who felt like they kind of had a level of status by the nature of being white, by the nature of being men. And if we help minorities and others rise up, that lowers this baseline status that I have. And so they wanted to fight back. It was, I'm going to keep these people down because it keeps me up. And when Radley said they're projecting masculinity, I think that's a big part. I think a big part of the appeal is I'm seeing guys like me dominating now. I'm seeing guys who are from my area or share my cultural values or dress like me or are into the same slogans or have the same fantasies of power as I do or just aren't the coastal elites with their fancy educations and so on, dominating. And my worry is that if that's what's driving a lot of it, and that urge to domination coupled with the fear, which I think then allows them to like overcome any barriers they have to cruelty, because if you like marry, I can have power and I'm scared of these people, that justifies in the same way that the action movie heroes killing the guys who put the pig's blood, like it becomes justified to inflict cruelty upon them. My worry is if you go after them in that way, it feels like, okay, now what you're doing is you're saying these guys who look like me who were dominating don't actually deserve it. And I don't think that means that we stay away from it, but I think it risks triggering even more this like, what I want is I want it to be my boot on people's necks and I want them to stop putting me down and I want them to stop telling me that I'm not good, that I'm incompetent, that it's not okay for me to beat my wife or whatever it happens to be. But like, I think that's bound up. You know, Chris, Trump is like an avatar of very mediocre men. And
I wouldn't use that as a talking point.
Well, a few years ago, I wrote a piece about a black police chief that was hired in Little Rock by a mayor who ran on a reform platform. And this police chief had a good record. He was in, I want to say Norman, Oklahoma, before that. He was the first black chief in Oklahoma. And, you know, he was not, you know, a progressive by any means, but he was a reformer in that he wanted things to be merit-based. And Little Rock is a really strong white police union. And I say that because they also have a black police union because the black officers didn't feel like they were represented by the white union. And so one of the first things that Chief Humphrey did was he made the promotional interviews that you get to move up through the ranks blind, right? So you didn't know who you were talking to. So you didn't know if it was a fellow white person, if you were white, because most of the people in charge were. And the result of that process of kind of removing race from that process was that more black officers were getting promoted than before. And when I was writing about it, I wrote about him because he ended up getting chased out of town and with like fake sexual harassment charges. They claimed he was harassing white women. The union did. And, you know, basically they exerted their power and managed to chase him out. But one of the things he told me when I interviewed him was, you know, and other people have said different versions of this, but you know, when your entire life, like you've been the beneficiary of racial preferences as a white person, as has happened in this country for most of our country's existence, meritocracy looks a lot like racial discrimination, right? Because things that you got just simply because you were entitled to, now you have to earn. And that looks like, hey, this black guy is getting this job over me. And that's not right, because my dad got that job over the black guy and his dad got the job over the black guy. I think this backlash that we're seeing against DEI, I'm sure there are parts of this country where DEI was, you know, promoting unqualified people just to have diversity. And I do think there's value in diversity for diversity's sake also. But I think a lot of the backlash to DEI is white people who have been benefiting from our sort of racial hierarchy system that's been in place, you know, since the founding, were starting to see themselves passed over because we were now moving to a merit-based system, and they saw that as discrimination. And that's a big part of the backlash, I think, that we're seeing now. I don't know what the solution is. I don't know that we just reimpose all of these policies, you know, once Trump's out of power, if he's ever out of power. I do think that there is value in diversity for diversity's sake. I don't, you know, think that we should, obviously I don't support sort of strict quota systems or whatever, but I do think it's important to sort of make that point also, right? That addressing these kind of historical injustices and historical, you know, I don't know. I'm rambling a little bit here, but just on a little bit of a side tangent, we went to the art museum in Nashville the other day, and they had a whole exhibit about Interstate I-40 going through Nashville. And it was supposed to go through this kind of industrial area where there were no neighborhoods or private homes. And the Tennessee legislature deliberately made it run through the wealthiest black neighborhood in Nashville and destroyed about 80% of black wealth, right, in the city. That was 1968. Right. That was not 1868. That's relatively recently that you're destroying a ton of wealth. And like that history, you can find it in every single city. And so I think a big part of this backlash is sort of not knowing that history, and then sort of only knowing what's happening now and sort of experiencing it out of context. And for those people, it feels like reverse discrimination, you know, and that's a term we're hearing a lot.
Okay, so I want to like recomplicate it. I mean, make it even more complicated, because yes, a lot of this is true, but it's not the whole story. So we can say that, you know, this is, we're going back to 1957, you know, in Little Rock and everything, but also, you know, there was a history that took place between that, including the civil rights movement, broad-based civil rights movement. In the state of Wisconsin, overwhelmingly white voters voted for Barack Obama, a black man, twice in a row before voting for Donald Trump. So you do have that long, deep history of racism, but then you also had America that I think was making some progress in all of this. And so I'm just going to put this out as just a sort of just a counterpoint on all of this, because I also think that if people were appealing to the better angels of their nature, that a lot of these people would not be buying into the cruelty, the brutality, the racism, and all of that. Instead, we're appealing to their sense of victimization. But let's be honest about it. We moved from a civil rights movement that was morally based on fairness and the immorality of discrimination to one that increasingly was identity politics that morphed into DEI, which was profoundly illiberal. We should probably have Yasha Monk here as opposed to me. But what happened was a lot of these guys were also thinking, not just they want their boots on people's head, but you know what? It's like they're constantly being told that they were bad, that their contributions were not significant. They were invisible tripwires of grievance, what you could say, what you could do, the way you had to behave. And I think if you go into a university campus, you know, in the before times, a lot of the attacks on free speech and the demands for ideological conformity were not coming from the illiberal right. They were coming from the illiberal left. And I think one of the problems, and maybe this is a little bit meta for this particular conference, but you know, as I'm listening to the speakers talk about this assault on liberalism, I think one of the questions we have to have is why it was so brittle. Well, it was brittle because it was caught in a pincer movement, you know, liberalism, by the illiberal left and the illiberal right. Okay, now I'm rambling. My point is that a lot of this reaction is, in fact, you know, based on racial animus. But there was also a, there's also a sense that I hear this from a lot of folks, just kind of a sense of liberation, that they feel that the boot was on their necks and is now being taken off, that they're not having to go to these highly ideological DEI training sessions where they were told, you know, how terrible and awful they were all the time, and how if you believed in a race-blind society, that was a sign you were racist. If you, if white women actually were moved by stories of racism and wept, that was white women's tears. This was heavy-handed. There was a backlash that was going to be inevitable. What's tragic is the way that it has been co-opted by the people who have I think really malign motives here, who are not acting out of goodwill, the Stephen Millers who have figured out a way to weaponize this. But that line that goes from the racism of 1957 to the civil rights movement in the 1960s to a broad-based civil rights consensus, which again, there's all caveats in all of this, to the identity-based politics, let's be honest about it. That was not without sin. That was not without problems.
So I agree that there was, I guess what you would call sort of an illiberal approach to kind of mutual exchange of ideas on college campuses. There was a lot of shouting down of conservative speakers. I think in some cases there were some invitations revoked to Senator Valedictory speeches. There's some like, you know, cutting off of funding for conservative speakers, but you know, I want to make sure we're not sort of delving into false equivalents here. I mean, the boot that you're talking about, Charlie, was a metaphorical boot.
Yes.
And we're talking about a very literal boot now.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I think the
a distinction that is a significant one.
Right. So, you know, I'm not my preferred way of expressing my disagreement with someone, even someone I disagree with vehemently, is not to shout them down. I will say, you know, I think protest is a form of speech. I think even to some extent, interrupting speeches that are particularly problematic or extremist is a form of speech. It's not one that I personally would engage in. I think the type of censorship we're seeing now is direct. It is government censorship. It is not, you know, sort of a violation of the spirit of free expression, I think, that we were seeing on college campuses before.
Oh, no, it was more than just the violation. I mean, you had universities that required people in order to get a job to sign a DEI statement where they had to made ideological commitments. I mean, this was very heavy-handed. There's not literal boots. But let's not, again, I like Jonathan Rauch's analogy that the illiberalism of the left is still a real problem, but it's like a slow-growing cancer. What we're facing with the illiberalism of the right is a heart attack right now, and we have to deal with the heart attack right now. But let's not pretend that everyone who objects to some of the things that were happening are doing so because they are just vile white racists. This is part of the problem. I think that people spent decades accusing people of, you're a racist if you support Mitt Romney, you're a racist if you support tax cuts, if you're a racist. You know what happened? I mean, I come from this world, and there was a time when to be called a racist was the worst thing you could possibly say about somebody. And it got to the point where literally, if you were in favor of school choice, you were a racist. If tax cuts, you were a racist. If you were in favor, you voted for a Republican. John McCain was a racist. George Bush was a racist. Everybody. So when the real thing came along, guess what people saw? Huh. They just rolled their eyes, shrugged, and said, we've heard this before. I mean, literally, it was crying wolf for decades. And so there are people who, when you say, how can you support? And I had these conversations. How can you support someone who is just espousing this raw, vicious racism about Haitians eating dogs? You know what I would get is like, oh man, we've been hearing this for 20 years. Literally everyone I know has been accused of being a racist. So part of what happened is that we need to come back to a consensus. We need to, if we're going to restore that liberal consensus, we're going to have to say, okay, you know, this is acceptable behavior, this is not acceptable behavior, and we are simply not going to use these labels to vilify. And by the way, one of the things that is the politics of contempt is just not helpful. It is not helpful to tell people, by the way, I think you're an idiot. I think you're stupid. I think you were racist. Would you like to hear my ideas about taxes now? It doesn't work. And I think that one of the things that tragically Trump has tapped into is the sense that these elites look down on you, you know? So when you say anyone who's doing this, you know, this is the revolution of mediocre men, not helpful. You know, you start that conversation, say you're a mediocre person if you have that position. That conversation's over. Now, some of them are mediocre. I certainly agree. I write about mediocre people all the freaking time. But again, the politics of contempt, I don't think is the way to get ourselves out of this.
Yeah, I think there's a distinction between messaging and diagnosis, though. And so if we're to understand how we got here or the kinds of beliefs or values that can lead someone, and I don't mean like, you know, you've been a partisan Republican voter for your entire life and you come from a family of this and you pulled the lever for Trump, but you're, you know, mostly an uninformed voter, which is a lot of people. I mean the people who are like watching this right now and cheering on Stephen Miller. You know, like they're, that's a different category. And so it might be that the message, if you have one of those people in front of you, is not to say like there's kind of a broken set of morals at play here or a cramped view of humanity at play here, because they're not going to hear that in the moment. But if we're to understand how we got here and what we're up against, I think we have to be fairly clear-eyed about the values that we've discovered over the last 10, 15 years have much more appeal and purchase among a lot of Americans than I think any of us had really expected or certainly hoped, and then figure out how to address that. Because if those values are central to, and again, it's not everybody, but it's, you know, it's more than I would like. If those values are central to someone's being and the way that they view others around them and the way they relate to their fellow man, then I think a lot of the less condemning arguments also won't find purchase, because ultimately they're not, it's not a policy difference. It's a, like, I want a crueler world.
You see, and this is where, again, I think the argument that says, let's look at this cruelty, let's look at this brutality, let's look at the Stephen Millers. Believe it or not, I actually think it's potent to say to somebody, do you want to be like that? Is that really what you want America to be? You're better than that. And then let me tell you the story of decency. The story that we heard about earlier today about, you know, somebody who votes for Trump, but they'll be there. You know, if your house is burning down or your father dies, they will be there. So there is, you appeal to that innate decency and say, do you really want to be this cruelty? And this is what's lacking, I think, in on the right in the Republican Party right now, is people who are going, okay, you may want smaller tax, you know, smaller government, you know, less taxes and everything. You may actually want to have, you know, a crackdown on street crime and less illegal immigration. But is this who you want to be? You know, show the mask to the officer, you know, who's dragging the grandmother away. I do think that there is the better angel that says, no, that's not the American story. And so you have to appeal to them as opposed to just condemn them. And I'm not sure we're disagreeing, but I actually do think that's potent.
I think there is not only room for ridicule when you're up against sort of an aspiring authoritarian. I think a lot of history shows it's often one of the few things that works, because they really hate to be disrespected. Now, you know, I think I agree with Charlie that I don't think it's necessarily productive to make fun of people, you know, who have been tricked or who have been lied to, but I also think, you know, it's worth pointing out that Trump has contempt for his own supporters, right? I mean, one of the great ironies of our time is, you know, when Trump would need a boost of self-esteem, he would go hold a rally in a state that, you know, before he ran for president, he would never have been caught dead in, right? He grifts from his own supporters. He, you know, his lies about COVID got his own supporters, you know, killed at higher rates than, you know, people in states that didn't vote for him. I agree. I don't think it serves much benefit to sort of denigrate people
but do ridicule the people who are doing it.
Yeah, it's the people
in
power.
I mean, don't get me wrong. Yeah. I mean, definitely. South Park is doing God's work right now.
Absolutely.
Well, in the time we have left, and I started with Radley, so I'll start this time with you. What then is the way forward? So let's assume that democracy survives this current moment, that right now the National Guard are not gathered outside ready to round all of us up. Democracy survives this current moment. We get through it. We somehow put Trump behind us. And we can't go back to the status quo. Like we can't just kind of say, well, we're going to go back to the institutions as they exist, that we're going to go back to kind of politics as it was during the Biden administration. That seems to be like off the table. We need something new. We need to have a new direction. What does that look like?
I honestly do not know at this point. I don't think anybody knows. But I do think that we ought to just remember, because we throw around the term liberal democracy a lot, is that democracies are not necessarily liberal. Democracies are not necessarily kind. And I think we need to go back to things like the rule of law. I think it's going to involve some kind of restoration of the balance of society, where, and I'm actually trying to think of the three points that you made a little bit earlier of the things that have to happen in this country. But I think that the damage that's being done now is so deep, and some of it is so irreparable, that I'm hoping that there will be a backlash against it, that there will be a pendulum swing back towards sort of fundamental decency. And even though we keep talking about democracy a lot, I think we need to start talking about freedom and decency a little bit more. Because again, democracies can be very, very problematic, but freedom, I think, understands. So, you know, there is, you know, listening to the Russian dissident who spoke tonight, and he's talking about, imagine what it's like trying to create a democratic society in Russia with all of their history and all of their institutions. As bad as things are for us, we have a big head start. We still have an infrastructure. You know, compared to what he is up against, we still can restore, I think, that sort of fundamental decency and sense of freedom and law and equality before the law.
I also don't know exactly what it's going to look like. I will say this. I think one of the big reasons why we are where we are today is that we did not properly, there wasn't a proper, what's the word I'm looking for? Thank you. There was not a proper reckoning after the Civil War, and Reconstruction was ended early. And I think that, you know, there was no real accountability. I think that's the same thing with January 6th, because there was no real accountability, because the Democrats waited too long for impeachment, because the DOJ, I've seen the argument that, you know, they did the best they could. I'll believe that, I guess. I do think there have to be repercussions. I don't think that, you know, I'm not saying that we throw everybody in the Trump administration in prison, but I do think, you know, the people who signed off on extraordinary rendition and snatching people off the street and sending them to a literal torture prison in El Salvador, I think those people need to be criminally charged. But I also think there need to be civil repercussion, or sort of civil society repercussions, I guess I'll say. There are so many people in media, pundits, politicians who know better, right? Who have a long record of pointing out how dangerous Trump was, and then turned on a dime and started supporting him. And I don't wish any physical harm on those people. I don't think, you know, any of those people should be, you know, put in prison. But I also think those people should never be trusted as public intellectuals again. I think we shouldn't employ them in that realm. I think, you know, if they want to wait tables or become bartenders, that's fine. You know, I think they should be able to earn a living. I don't think they should earn our trust. I have zero confidence that that's going to happen. But, you know, I can personally say that I have no interest in, you know, participating in events like this with those people. I have no interest in giving those people any kind of legitimacy because, you know, they try to take our birthright away from us, which is a free and democratic society, the country, you know, that is, you know, for all its flaws, has been a sort of exemplary country in the history of humankind. And they literally are trying to end that. And like, I don't think you just get to walk away from that and pretend like it never happened.
Totally agree.
With that, thank you, Radley. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you for listening to Zooming In, a project of The Unpopulist. To get all of the updates from our new series, Executive Watch, make sure to subscribe for free at theunpopulist.net. Until next time.